Time now for that weekly Sunday dip into the pool of ideas, the ideas, for better or worse, that help shape a new world. Today we'll hear some talk about a subject that's released an avalanche of controversy. Who should pay for medical care? And because it's a topic of international interest, our new world discussion will link two continents. So to begin, let's make a switch in a familiar direction. Monitor goes to the University of Chicago and Professor Edward W. Rosenheim, Jr.
Thanks to the kindness of the British Broadcasting Corporation, we're often able to make these New World programs transatlantic affairs. Generally, we've found a great deal of agreement on both sides of the ocean. And when there is disagreement, more often than not, it doesn't follow national lines. Today, however, we've quite deliberately chosen a topic on which, in principle and practice, British and Americans probably don't see eye to eye. Our question is, how shall we pay for medical care? And we're particularly honored in our participants, for speaking from London is Aneurin Bevan, Labour Member of Parliament and formerly both Minister of Health and Minister of Labour and National Service. From Edinburgh, we are joined by Walter Elliott, statesman, Conservative Member of Parliament, also a former Minister of Health. Here in America, we have Mr. E.A. Van Steenwyck, Director of the Blue Cross Plan for Philadelphia and the Lehigh Valley, and finally, my colleague, Milton Friedman, Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. I think the first question that's occurred to me in thinking of the participants here today is one that I should like to throw to you, if I may, Mr. Elliott. You are a conservative. As a conservative, do you disagree in any very fundamental way with the British plan for medical care, which is now in existence?
No, I should say that all parties in Britain are agreed. In 1945, before the health service came in, each party put it in its election manifesto. And although we had some argument while it was coming into existence, it is now accepted in its present form by all the parties in the state. And they would say in a word that nobody has put it in any political program that they would propose to go back to the system which we previously ran in this country.
Friedman, would you say that here in the United States there's any very substantial agreement on how medical care should be paid for?
I think there's substantial disagreement here, but the burden is on the other side. I think the major strength of public and professional opinion in this country would be that medical care should be paid for by the patient in his relation with the individual physician. But there is indeed a substantial minority which would like to see an extension of group payment for medical care.
Mr. Bevan, what accounts for the fact that all parties now seem agreed on the wisdom of the plan that you're following?
Well, it might be, you know, because it's a wise plan. if you have two great parties, like the Conservative Party and the Socialist Party of Britain, who have now joined in agreeing that the health plan of Great Britain must remain, surely that's the most obvious prima facie tribute to the plan itself.
Well, now, we have very different kinds of plans here. Mr. Van Steenwyck seems to me pretty well qualified to discuss at least one mode of voluntary prepayment for medical care. I'm going to turn things over to him for a moment.
Well, we've developed our own voluntary system, which meets the problem for those who are participating. And it must be said that by now more than 100 million Americans are participating, which presents a substantial growth in the last 25 years. I can remember, for instance, when I started out in the Middle West, that at that time there were but 5,000 subscribers, and by now we have 50 million subscribers. In that year, 25 years ago, we paid our hospitals about $15,000 between two plans, and by now, this year, we will be paying our hospitals $1 billion.
Friedman here. I want to see if we can get to what seems to me the central issue in our dispute across the Atlantic, which is the question how best to use the scarce and limited resources of medical service. The British method is to use it by having people pay for it through indirectly in the form of taxes to the state, and then have the right to go to a physician without specific charge for each service. Our main method is to have individuals pay for it directly by going to the physician of his choice and paying a fee for each visit. The point I would like to emphasize is that it seems to me the British method is a method ideally designed to waste the valuable and scarce resource of the physician by giving an undue incentive to hypochondriacs and other people who would like to waste services to try to misuse them.
But wait a minute. I'm speaking as a physician. This is Walter Elliott here. And isn't there the other chance of the waste of the most valuable thing in the world, the recuperative power of the patient, by a delay in going to the medical man in before his recuperative powers are exhausted? The first thing necessary is to get the earliest possible contact of the doctor with the patient. That really seems to me the most useful way of using the resources of the scarce resources of the country, that we should bring at the very earliest possible moment the maximum of medical care and attention to bear on the patient. You've got to lump the hypochondriac.
And also, this is Bevan speaking, hasn't the British experience completely answered the allegation? What Mr. Friedman is doing is bringing a theory to bear. Why have the theory when we have the practice? Well, this is exactly what was said before the National Health Service came into existence. Now you were told that both the political parties in Great Britain favor it, and so do the vast mass of the medical profession. And as to the hypochondriacs, isn't it the fact that now the doctor can treat the patient who needs to have the treatment and ignore the hypochondriac?
Having spent a year in Great Britain and having observed the operation of medical care, I am prepared to argue that the point I'm making is more than a theoretical point. It is a practical point, that the problem of long waiting lists to get into hospitals, the problem of crowded waiting rooms of physicians, is a problem that exists in reality and not only in the imagination of a theorist.
Yes, but then what you're really saying is that you desire that the financial disability which is imposed upon a potential patient in the United States should keep them away from the hospitals and the surgeries. And you regard that good therapeutics, do you?
Not at all. I don't regard that at all. But there are a limited number of physicians, a limited number of hospitals. They are fully occupied here.
And therefore the rich will have them first. Is that the idea?
No, it is not the idea.
Is that the practice?
It is neither the idea nor the practice.
Well, obviously, it follows from what you have said. If you rely upon financial anxieties to keep people away, or to use your own words, not to overuse the scarce services, such anxieties might exist with the rich, so they will have access to the services first of all. Is that equitable?
Mr. Bevan, I think you are confusing two very different problems. One is the problem of the general distribution of income among people, which arises with respect to food, clothes, housing, and everything else. Medical care is a minor item. Medical care accounts in your country, as in mine, for no more than 5% of the total expenditures on consumption. It accounts in your country, as in mine, for less than the cost of tobacco plus alcohol.
I know, but wait a minute. This is Walter Elliott. I'm holding myself in with the greatest difficulty. I was a doctor. I was on the gate. I compiled these waiting lists. And I can assure you that in a good many cases, people who urgently needed treatment weren't getting it because there wasn't a hospital accommodation there. Now, one of our difficulties was this very expansion of hospital accommodation. Do you think in America you can look after this enormously increased hospital accommodation, which will admittedly be necessary?
We don't rely on donations to run our hospital. About 90% of all the money spent by our voluntary hospitals comes from patients. But let me ask this.
Yeah.
Isn't it true that more and more in England, the individual is tending toward the purchase of supplementary insurance?
Well, but wait a minute. 98% of the people are using the health service. It's a good thing that there should be a margin. You'll always get a margin. I'm greatly in favor of a margin. If a chap wants to use some entirely different system of curing, such as Christian Science, why shouldn't he use that?
But
98% of the population here use the health services. I don't think we can get away from that one.
Friedman here, but if... If you really wanted to have a test as to whether people like the health service or not, it would be necessary to allow them to contract out while not paying for it.
This is Bevan speaking. The National Health Service of Great Britain isn't a compulsory affair. And Mr. Friedman, I'm afraid you've got the whole thing quite wrong, you know.
I beg your pardon.
What you've done is to start off with a number of inhibitions and a priori assumptions and trying to fit the British system into them.
Mr. Bevan, I beg your pardon, but isn't it true that a very large fraction of all the costs of health service are met from general tax revenues?
Well, yes, of course, but that's...
Well, then, can an individual...
Taxes have to be paid, of course, but the individual's share in them is not known.
But can an individual contract out in the sense of not paying for
his... He can't contract out of not paying the taxes any more than he can contract out from not paying the Navy or the Air Force.
Well, but then you're giving him a Hobson's choice. You're saying he can buy services elsewhere, but he gets no return for not using the services which would otherwise be
precisely
available.
Precisely.
Wait a minute. I'm opposed to this 100% argument between London and New York. Edinburgh's got to come into it somewhere. Let me quote an actual inquiry which was held not by the state or by the patients, indeed, but by the doctor. It was held by the British Medical Association, and the results for a pretty good survey covering some 200 representative doctors and a much larger number of patients, and that's as recently as 1953, and their findings were that practitioners, on the whole, are happier in their relationship with patients now that fee charging and the rendering of accounts are almost a thing of the past.
I regard that as proof solely that the physicians are being reasonably well remunerated under the system.
No.
I should hardly think that in any field in which we want consumers to be sovereign, the satisfaction of the producers is a relevant test.
I should have thought in the States the kick mostly was coming from the practitioner. At least all the...
Yeah.
And the people I've talked to in the States, the people who are really opposed to it are the doctor.
The ADA.
A great many of the patients, especially the middle-class patients, say we wish to goodness that we could avoid the terrible fear of these enormous medical bills, which actually hampers us from making use of medical skill which we know is there.
That's really not a problem in this country, Mr. Elliott.
Our people are
getting all the care that they need and want.
Isn't it a fact that in many of your industries, wage discussions now take place with medical care attached to them?
Oh, indeed.
Isn't that in other words, isn't that a very evil and dangerous development
in which
health services become part of a contractual relationship between an employer and his workmen?
We think that that...
Is that a desirable state of affairs, do you think?
On the contrary, we think it is a desirable
thing. Well, on the contrary, I was told by American treaty union leaders... one of the reasons why they demanded that was in order to compel the employer to support state schemes. Let me put the point to you. This is the point as it was put to me. It is perfectly clear that the individual in America can't rely upon his resources alone in order to obtain medical care when he wants it. And therefore he joins a group scheme.
Right.
These group schemes are themselves an admission that some collective agency is necessary to help the individual.
Quite right, in my opinion.
These group schemes in themselves are unsatisfactory to a large number of Americans, and so a large number of American regional leaders attempt to attach medical care to the wage contract.
Oh, no, that's not so at all.
But it is so.
Mr. Bevan, there's a fundamental difference between voluntary schemes entered in by groups of individuals and schemes imposed universally. But I want to take you back to a more important and basic point on the question of the quality and quantity of medical care. It is a fact, I take it, that in the United States, there's one physician to every approximately every 750 people. On the other hand, in the United Kingdom, as I understand the figures, there's about one physician to every, 1,300 or 1,400 people. In consequence, so far as the amount of medical care that is available, unless you are prepared to say that British physicians are on the average of a higher quality or more effective or work longer hours, greatly longer hours or something like that, it seems clear that the total amount of medical care being made available in this country is substantially higher.
Mr. Friedman, this is Bevan speaking. How are those doctors distributed? Have you got those figures?
This is Walter Elliott here speaking. After all, we have a very important question to survey. We haven't very long to survey it in. The fact is that although you may say there is, checking the statistics as to whether there are fewer or more doctors in the States than there are in the United Kingdom per head of population, the fact is that the number of doctors entering our schools has not fallen off in the years since the National Health Service came in. Whatever the supply of doctors now, it is as good as the supply of doctors when we were working under a free system. I do still think we come back to the position And I don't think, if I may say so, you've answered it from the other side of the Atlantic. Do you not really believe that the earliest possible access of the patient, even if it is an unimportant ailment, to a medical man is of the greatest possible significance in the treatment and cure of disease?
So far as it is, the individual separately has every, this is Friedman here, has every incentive to make his visit to the physician, and I think one will find that as you have, as this turns out to be the case, you find people going to physicians here at much earlier stages than they might at an earlier time. But going back to the earlier point, Mr. Elliott, it is precisely because of the scarcity of your medical services and your medical resources that it seems to me you really can't afford to waste them through the National Health Service. Well, let me ask you one question on this.
Yes, sure.
Do you see any, so long as you're going to provide medical care free in terms of the individual visit, it's not free, you have to pay for it through taxes, but in terms of the individual visit,
yes,
do you see any upper limit to the total amount of medical care or physicians that can be demanded? Do you see any way of ultimately ever satisfying the demand?
Well, no demand can ever be completely satisfied, but we do find that in many cases, the hump, so to speak, is passing. Let me take one single instance. Deaf aids. The problem of the deaf was a very serious matter before. On the whole, as soon as deaf aids were available, an enormous number of deaf aids were demanded. The first estimates were about 100,000 to 150,000. It worked out that they needed something like 500,000. But the waiting list at that time was enormous, say a year. The waiting list is now down to 3 weeks. And on the whole, a man can wear a hearing aid in this country with no more self-consciousness than he can wear a pair of spectacles. And I think that's a good thing, because previously, let's face it, a man didn't dare to wear a hearing aid. He was regarded as a man with a disability, and he had a less good chance of employment. Now, we were wasting not merely medical skills here, but we were wasting the most important thing in the whole world, the skill of trained hand. Now, that's available far and wide. And that hump has passed off, and that is going to be our experience, I firmly believe, in many other fields of medicine as well.
Now, one question that I think is on the minds of all of us in America is why, in Great Britain, recognizing the medical needs that did exist a number of years ago, why you chose this plan rather than a voluntary one of the sort that we have here in this country?
Because ours is much more effective. In the second instance, because we found in 1945, at least I found when I got to the Ministry of Health, that at least one-third of the cost of all hospitals now had to be borne by the state. I'm talking about the voluntary hospitals. And therefore, it is perfectly obvious that the voluntary principle had broken down. And in next place, our hospitals were badly distributed. They had been erected where the caprice of private charity determined, and not where the needs of the population required.
I think it's not always recognized that we've tried out the other system. We had A, the insurance system, and B, we had the voluntary prepayment in certain great cities such as Birmingham. Enormous schemes were in progress by which the Birmingham work people paid a contribution to the hospital. They preferred to merge the thing into one and to say we shall merge the old insurance system, which, mind you, went back to 1911, and we will merge the newly developing prepayment system into a general system whereby a contribution is levied from everybody and everybody takes advantage. It was our experience which led us to take up this present system. We found the other one wasn't working.
Now, isn't it true, though, that your earlier voluntary systems just did not bring into medical care enough money to do anything but a token? And our situation is quite different. Our voluntary systems are really providing sufficient money to take care of the medical and hospital care needs of our people.
I should have thought that the statistics you just quoted disprove that. You say 100 million people are covered, but that's it. The United States population is a great deal larger than that. And I'm rather speaking for the harassed middle class. It's all right for the proletariat. They can cover themselves on these schemes. But my experience is that the people who really suffer from that is the middle class.
Are those 100 million people in the group schemes of America covered for all the ranges of medical benefit and hospitalization?
Not all.
Exactly. So that figure is a delusive one, isn't it?
No.
It only covers a part of medical care, not the whole of medical care.
Gentlemen, but I see a gleam in Mr. Friedman's economist's eye at this point, and I think I'm going to let him cut in on the discussion for just a moment, for our time is almost over.
I wanted to say two things. The first is that I take it we would hardly agree that whatever is therefore right. And the mere fact that Britain did decide to move in this direction rather than in some other direction is, I think, no real evidence that this is a desirable direction. With respect to the other problem of coverage of all of medical care, the costs must, it should be emphasized, be borne out of the purse of the pockets of the people of the country as a whole.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that the question of the cost of a hearing aid or of anything else is the same on both sides. You have to pay for it, we have to pay for it. The problem is, does one method of paying for it or another method of paying for it see that you get better service, more effectively produced?
Oh, isn't there the other argument as to whether the person who most needs it gets it according to his need or gets it according to his pocket?
Gentlemen, it seems to me we're in the midst of an argument from which perhaps we would be able to extricate ourselves if we had any more time. Unhappily, we don't. It does seem to me that this kind of international controversy is perhaps the healthiest kind of international controversy. I think we have had heat, and I think we've had light, too. We've heard this morning from Aneurin Bevan, Labour Member of Parliament and former Minister of Health, speaking from London. From Edinburgh, we've heard from Walter Elliott, also a former Minister of Health and Conservative Member of Parliament. Here in the United States, our participants have been E.A. Van Steenwyck, Director of the Blue Cross Plan for Philadelphia, and Professor Milton Friedman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. Now, this is Edward Rosenheim returning you to Radio Central, New York.
Who shall pay for medical care? A new world discussion of a controversial topic, considered by experts on two sides of the Atlantic as discussed on Monitor.